Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, May 2nd. Today we explore history tied to a forgotten boarding school. It was a reformatory and industrial school for boys in Wailea. A charter school wins national recognition for its innovation. Sustainability is in its mission, and the Hope Impact Award comes at a good time. And forever Kaimu Ki, we meet the man behind a collection of sketches that memorializes a neighborhood that nurtured him and so many others. Plus, popular Maui music artist Stan Walker joins us for a chat. His two biggest inspirations, the king of reggae, Bob Marley, and a queen that might surprise you. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It was 2 years ago this month that the U.S. Interior Department released a report into troubling policies in place at what was called Indian boarding schools across the country. The report also made mention of seven schools in Hawaii. HPR reporter Kube Hiraishi took a visit out to one of those sites. It's on Oahu's North Shore. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Yes, folks might remember or know about the sort of abandoned home, the old Crawford's Convalescent Home in Kahuku. So about 5 miles north of Kahuku on the North Shore. This was the home of the former Wailea Industrial School for Boys. And Wailea, is an old farming and fishing community there. There are records of dozens of Kuleana landowners who resided in the area up until, after the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom. That's when it became the site for this Wailea Industrial School for Boys that you, as you mentioned, was listed in the DOI report for federal Indian boarding schools. And a key difference, I would say, between this school and the federal Indian boarding schools was that these were essentially the first reformatory, right? Mm-hmm. So basically a government-run juvenile detention facility. Boys were sent to the home mostly for skipping school or stealing something. The idea was that they were being trained to be able to go into some kind of trade and to provide low-cost labor to the surrounding plantations. So this was 1901 through about mid-1900s. The schools themselves were pretty self-sustaining in that they had pretty extensive farms and raised livestock like sheep and cows. Records show the boys' school out at Wailea actually produced up to 1,000 pounds of poi each week. And, I just had to see this place for myself. So I joined in a community work day at Wailea this past Saturday, hosted by the North Shore Community Land Trust. So Kavila Kaiferant, Coastal Community Resilience Specialist with the Trust, says uncovering the history of the institution is part of a larger community effort to reconnect people to this place and its stories.
Yeah, we really still have a lot of questions about how that history unfolded. There are people who may still be alive and others who attended the school who might have fond memories of the school, because you get 200 boys together, they're going to have fun, they're going to be kolohe. There's lots of accounts of them running away into the mountains, and I'm sure that was a good time, but you have to ask yourself, why were they running away? Was it good condition? Were they, being treated well? And maybe at times they were, maybe at times they weren't. That's the importance of learning about this history so that we can learn more.
Yeah, and I just did a quick Google about this school and saw on Peter Young's website that the disciplinary practices were pretty harsh back then.
They were, and records in the Hawaii State Archives, because this was a government-run school, so there are records, and there's sort of, we wonder what wasn't recorded. It wasn't in their interest to record all of the bad stuff, but there were record instances of physical abuse, lashings, beatings. Kids were put in leg irons or, you know, ball and chain. And in at least one case, a boy had at Waialae had passed away from the abuse he sustained from staff. And so the trust recently received a federal grant in partnership with Dr. Miley Arvin from the University of Utah, who I'll get to in a bit, to conduct some oral history research and story mapping around this history and sort of really looking at the ramifications of that history, not only on the students at the time, but on the generations that follow. Polly Ahudule, whose 90-year-old Hanai grandfather was sent to Waialae as a teenager, came to the community work day with her daughter. She had heard stories from her grandfather, but never had a chance to visit Waialae. And as one would imagine, it was a pretty emotional one for her. She shared her grandfather actually learned to plant and grow kalo at Waialae, and many of his long-lasting friendships come from his time at the boys' school.
That's so Hawaiian that we're just going to be like, oh, yeah, but we're super grateful because, you know, I learned all this kind of stuff. And I think it's easy to forget the people who live it. Easy to forget that, you know, like for some, as researchers, you're looking from the outside in. So it's easy to say, no, we cannot have it. No, we cannot have it. And then the people who live it, right? Like my grandfather doesn't regret it. You know, it was an important part of his life. It's an important part of his story and what made him who he is today.
And when she talks about that, so, you know, we didn't need to have it or we don't need to have it. She's talking about the school, right? The idea of having a place where a majority Native Hawaiians were sent children. And that's part of the reckoning, as you some would say, for lack of a better word, that this research project is sort of becoming a catalyst for what really happened at these institutions. And more importantly, what do the families who have been impacted by these institutions want to shed some light on? And we were talking about this earlier, Catherine, right? The DOI report, the section for Hawaii, was pretty small in terms of what we know and what has been uncovered about these schools. And Waialae is one of just seven for this particular project. The group is only looking at training or industrial schools because we know three boarding schools, so Kamehameha, Lahaina Luna, and Hilo Boarding School, were also listed in there. They are not the subject of this particular research project. But a key difference, as I mentioned earlier, is that this school wasn't like the federal Indian boarding schools where you would take the kids away from the home for, you know, just to force assimilation. The kids technically had to have committed a crime. And whether or not, you know, how loosely vetting process was, is something that's kind of at the heart of this. But Dr. Miley Arvin, who had mentioned earlier, head of Pacific Island Studies there at University of Utah, is partnering with Ferrant and the Trust to carry out that research. And she says, you know, there were some similarities.
So we're still kind of determining what exactly happened at these institutions, but certainly there are a lot of similarities with Native American boarding schools in the sense that the children that were placed at these institutions during the territorial period were subject to, you know, really forced assimilation practices, just as Native American children were in boarding schools where, you know, they weren't supposed to speak Hawaiian or other non-English languages. There are also differences. And then I think there's also in Hawaii, there just hasn't been the same amount of research done or kind of like public reckoning as there has been in Native American communities. And so I think we still don't actually know enough.
Arvin and Ferrant plan to do more community outreach in Hawaii this summer. The research project is called Nale Poina Ole in reference to an old Hawaiian proverb, Olalonoeal, meaning a beloved child is a lei never forgotten, which Arvin says kind of helps frame the research approach.
None of this was a natural thing to do to children from Hawaiian worldviews, right? I think the title of our project helps us remember just how beloved children are to Hawaiians. And keeping that in mind as we do this work is really helpful. And I think it centers us in the belief that, like, no children should have been treated like this. No, like, families should not have been treated like this. And, you know, we hope the work we do helps ensure that this doesn't keep happening.
So the group is building out a website, nalepuinoole.com, where they're kind of putting some of the research they've already found, but also reaching out to families who might be descendants of folks who might have heard stories about the Waialae school or any of the industrial schools.
Yeah, it would be interesting to find out, you know, what's out there for those other ones as well. But interesting history, fascinating.
Right, no, for sure. And I'm looking forward to hearing more stories.
Yes, well, thank you so much.
Thanks.
That was HPR's Kuvehi Reishi with a look at the forgotten history on Oahu's North Shore.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. Fashioning Aloha traces the history of Aloha wear from the 1930s to the present. Now on view, honolulumuseum.org.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jude Curravan, author of The Cosmic Hologram, Information at the Center of Creation. And next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about the unified nature of reality.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses designed to engage the mind and enrich lives. Classes begin June 3rd. More by searching OLLIUHM.
Called the Building Hope Impact Award. It's a competitive award that is presented to just a handful of charter schools across the country. And this year, Hawaii won top honors. We had featured SEEK School when it made the semifinals earlier this year. SEEK stands for School for Examining Essential Questions of Sustainability. And last week in Florida at the Building Hope Summit, it won for Education Innovation. We invited Executive Director Buffy Cushman-Pates back to talk with us. The award was a bright spot for the school community, which suffered the tragic loss of one of its sixth graders recently in a murder-suicide case that shook our community. So the news of the win came like a warm hug. Here's Cushman Pates.
It was fantastic, honestly, to be in a group of other charter school leaders who are doing the same challenging work, but they're all innovative school leaders. I mean, everyone that was there was either a finalist for the award this year or had won the award last year or the year before. There were other folks at the summit, too, but most of the folks I engaged with were other winners and people who are leading, many of us founders or executive directors of innovative or impactful public charter schools all across the country. It was just really nice to be with other folks doing such similar work and experiencing many of the same challenges.
And the fact that you've won this award, I mean, gosh, it is nice validation about the work that we're doing here in Hawaii.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And one of the things I had to do there as part of the determination of who would finally win was I had to give an impact talk, which was a 10-minute talk. They referred to it as a TED-like talk where there were no notes, no slides, just talking about our school. And, you know, I talked about the design elements of our school, but gave the specific examples of a specific essential question of sustainability course, EQS Chi, and how they're examining how can restoration solutions help mitigate the impacts of invasive species. And I talked about how our students go and do invasive algae pulls in Kaneohe Bay on a regular basis, and how they did EQS Camp, and they partnered with Malama Manuloa and did invasive algae pulls there, and really got a chance to talk about not just sort of the design elements of our school, but how they play out and what those experiences are like for students on a daily, weekly, and yearly basis.
You know, I guess, though, when you interact with, you know, your colleagues, right, in other schools across the country, to be able to see the innovation. I mean, I think it's so exciting when you see how creative people can get.
Definitely. And then we all, of course, get ideas from each other. We say, oh, how do you do this? How do you do that? Oh, what does your advisor look like? Oh, how do your teachers manage this? And we just just can just talk all day long and get ideas from each other, share with each other, learn from each other, and feel both inspired by and supported by each other.
Yeah, the synergy, you just feed off that.
Absolutely.
Craziness.
Absolutely. It was such a great week for me as a leader. It was really validating and reinvigorating.
And so the award comes with a check.
Yes.
And so what's the plan?
We're always expanding on and wanting to invest in our students and the investigations they do, the field experiences, the community partnerships, the project work. All of that takes an investment of time, of course, project supplies, and then paying our people who work at our school as well. You know, the teachers, many of them have leadership roles that help make these things happen and spend time in and out of campus and making sure that all of those programs are funded. As a public charter school, we don't necessarily get enough funds to do all the work that we're doing because we also have to pay facilities expenses out of our per pupil funding. And so we do supplement funding at our school with grants and awards like this, as well as donations from folks. And those things really help us make sure that we can offer a super high quality curriculum that is everything that parents envision and want on the funds that we get, and we need those supplemental funds to help with that. And so it really does help expand our programming, as well as our one-to-one iPad program, things like that that cost money.
Yeah, but really, though, it's not about the money.
It's not about the money at all. It's a grant that has no, what do you call that?
Strings attached?
Yeah, no strings attached grant, unrestricted funds, which just means that we can apply it where we need it the most at any given time, which is super helpful.
Yeah, and this award comes at a time because it's been a tough year for the school.
It has.
You had a loss of one of your students.
Yeah, we did.
It's a tragic community loss for the Oda family and all the schools where those students attended.
All the schools that the students attended, I think all of us in the state, on the island of Oahu, I think all of us who are parents, and definitely our school community was deeply impacted by the loss of Orion. So unexpectedly and absolutely devastating to our whole school community. I will say that we have a strong community. We're a relatively small school, 180 students, middle school, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. We have a lot of multi-age classes, so everybody knows everybody, which means that nearly all of us were impacted. Everyone knew Orion. But it also meant that we have a lot of, our strong community means we had a lot of structures already in place that we could lean on, and a lot of strong relationships with each other that enabled us to come into school and grieve together. And students and teachers have advisory groups, and they came to school on Monday and we shared the news. I mean, I don't want to overstate it. It was the most devastating thing I've ever experienced as a school leader and hope to ever, ever have to deal with again. But we have a strong community and we've put a lot of love and thought towards Orion and his family and continue to do so.
You know, you're about to close out the year, you know, with the school, and I guess just looking back and, you know, it's a traumatic experience losing Orion. But, you know, folks have hope, you know, for healing for everybody.
Yeah.
And the news of this award is, again, hopeful, right?
Yes.
I mean, gosh, you just want to be able to help each other, you know, whether you're a big school or a small school, a charter school or a private school. To have this award come, you know, during a difficult year. You know?
Yes. It's definitely a bright light in a dark year, is the way I would put it, or a dark semester. It hasn't actually been. It's actually been a really great year in a lot of ways. A lot of ways. In other years, this year would feel like a standout because this award is meaningful. It's nice recognition. We've got a lot of good things on the horizon coming forward. We've got, you know, a new school year always brings a lot of hope and opportunity and possibility. And being recognized as with a national award for education innovation gives us a little bit of inspiration to keep doing the work that we're doing, and a lot of pride in our ability to make meaningful learning experiences for students where they're part of a strong community and they have rigorous academic content courses and they have application of that content in context that is super place-based here in Hawaii, where students are examining questions essential to Hawaii's future. I think being recognized for that model, for this model, allows us to kind of take a breath and look at the big picture and say, we're doing important work, we're doing meaningful work, and it is making a difference in students. And I think everyone will remember this year, for better or for worse, but definitely a year where we grew even stronger as a community, a resilient community, and it's nice to have recognition.
You know, we just had a couple of guests in studio. It's a new school that's starting up this fall, Kalia Academy, mm-hmm. right? You know, AI, and it's just, it was exciting to hear their journey. Mm-hmm. You know, parents who just wanted something for their children, and it's taken many years to see this come to fruition, but it was very exciting, yeah. feeling their energy about yeah. where they want to go.
Awesome. And yeah, we're 11 years in, and we're in a different stage now than we were. I remember that stage myself from 11 years ago, but now to be at this stage and to get national recognition for what we are doing and what we've been doing, it's really gratifying.
That was Buffy Cushman Pates, Executive Director of the SEEK School, which won the top prize for education innovation for charter schools. Cushman Pates attended the Building Hope Summit, which was held in Florida just about a week ago. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Pretty well known that Hawaii has a problem with invasive species. The mild climate and lack of major predators make the Hawaiian Islands a fertile habitat for plants and animals from all over the world. Mongoose, mosquitoes, even the kiawe tree are all examples of invasive species that are well established in Hawaii. Today, we delve into the history of an interesting invasive species that is also one of the most elusive, the wallaby. It's a small mammal from Australia belonging to the same family as the kangaroo. In fact, apart from the size, they are so similar that you might easily mistake them for each other. Believe it or not, Hawaii has a small but stable population of wild wallabies living on Oahu. The exact population size is difficult to determine because the animals are skittish, but estimates place the colony at around 40 individuals living in Kalihi Valley. Wallabies were brought to Hawaii in the early 20th century as an exhibit for a private zoo. For today's backyard quiz, we want to know, what was the name of the man who owned this zoo? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, supporting nonprofits such as the Molokai Affordable Housing Alliance, providing kupuna with resources for building affordable homes on Molokai. NareitHawaii.com.
In 1956, a federal judge ordered the town of Clinton, Tennessee, to desegregate its high school.
By the end of the week, the entire town had exploded. The National Guard had to come in. Eventually, the school was bombed and destroyed and rebuilt by the evangelist, Billy Graham.
The forgotten story of desegregation in Clinton, Tennessee. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Outrigger Resorts and Hotels, featuring the sights and sounds of beaches throughout the islands, live music, and cultural experiences. Learn more at outrigger.com.
The sleepy town of Kaimuki comes alive through the ink sketches of retired G70 architect Hitoshi Ihida. He moved to Hawaii with his family from Hiroshima, Japan in the 1960s. The McKinley High School graduate went on to earn his architecture degree at the University of Hawaii. Hida's new book, Sketches of Kaimuki, is a collection of his drawings of the people and architecture of a neighborhood near and dear to his heart. The Conversation's Lillian Song sat down in our studio with Hida.
Kaimuki is a special place. I lived on the 12th Avenue. That was in 1976. But then we moved to a house near Kahala, high enough that we could see ocean and also could see Kaimuki Hill. As I said in the book, it's a very quaint and unassuming, it's very heartwarming town. And the scale, building scales, just fit for me. When I see something, oh my, I have to take a picture of this, and then I have to go home and get the camera and bring it out and take a picture of them. I don't sketch on the street, you know, standing up or anything. I take pictures, yeah, and then I bring it home. Mm-hmm. I mean, in those days, you have to send it to Long so to develop and wait for like a week or something.
Right, right.
No, not like now, you know, in iPhone, you can do it anyway, but...
Your eye for composition, though, when you're looking at the scene, your camera is capturing the composition for you.
Yeah.
From that print is what you are sketching from.
Right.
It's almost like a time capsule because you are drawing things where they no longer exist. Like here I see like a newspaper stand, you know, for the advertiser.
Yeah, yeah. My style is very realistic.
These little things that maybe you take for granted. So to see like... newspaper stand. People don't use those anymore.
Yeah. You see this drawing?
Page 99.
It's one of the early drawings. You know, as you go down the Wailea Avenue, mm-hmm. all the way down, and you pass the highway on the bridge, that's what you see. The house.
Is the house still there?
Yeah, it's still there. But okay. As I mentioned in the book, the tree in the back of the no fork pine, that's about 2 times as tall. Yeah, and then you see the... It's a mango tree.
Mm-hmm.
It's big too.
Oh, so the foliage is filled up behind the house.
Yeah, bigger now.
So passage of time. You captured it when they were still juveniles. But now they're all adult.
Yeah.
Adult trees.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How long have you been in retirement?
Almost 7 years. You know, when you have lots of time, you tend to... efficiency seems to go down. You know, when you're working, you know, within a limited time after work or a weekend, you know, produce artwork. I mean, that's what I was doing when I did this book.
Mm.
But now I do mostly pastel work.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, getting back to your book, Sketches of Kaimuki, it's beautifully printed, and on each page you have a little vignette, a description mm-hmm. in English and Japanese, mm-hmm. and on the facing page, it's your sketch.
Mm-hmm.
So just starting off with Pu'u'o Kaimuki, Kaimuki Hill, where you moved into, right? Mm-hmm. That view that you saw every morning from your house?
Yeah.
Really curious. So were you inspired by others who saw your sketches and they told you, Hitoshi, you have to put something together?
Yeah. Some of my friends, you know, when I showed the original and it was kind of falling apart.
Wow. Your sketchbook even feels like a book. You've replicated what it feels like to thumb through your personal original sketchbook.
Yeah.
This is really cool.
Oh, yeah? Oh.
Yes. Oh, I recognize this one, Harry's Music Store.
Yeah.
So, as a person who's been drawing Kaimuki all this time, the architecture relatively the same unless people start building monster houses or mm-hmm. things get torn down. The mm-hmm. facade of buildings have stayed the same. I just recognized Harry's. What do you feel about Kaimuki now as you walk through it, as you drive through it?
Oh, I still feel the majority of the feeling that I used to get is still there. And, you know, there are changes, but they haven't made humongous changes. There are some bigger buildings now on the Cokehead side of Wailea Avenue, you know, 5-story, 6-story kind of buildings. But the rest is, I think, is still there and haven't changed. the business have changed, but buildings haven't changed, and the atmosphere haven't changed. Yeah.
You know, time in Kamiki has definitely moved on, but the fabric, the buildings of Kamiki that you first saw 40 years ago, the majority, that structure of the architecture, the buildings of Kamiki are still there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have you befriended them?
Yeah. You know, especially like the fire station. You know, that area haven't changed. You know, looking toward the fire station, if you look backwards, they're the big buildings now. Mm. I mean, bigger buildings, but it's not as bad as Kakahako or anything like that. Yeah, and the views looking toward Wilhelmina Heights haven't changed. And the Queen's Theater still have that old broken...
The facade, the marquee is still there.
Still there.
Yes.
Yeah. Because my parents used to live on the 8th Avenue, and I, you know, every time, they didn't have a car, so every time they have to go someplace, I have to pick them up and drive up, and the Mauna Loa Road is always the one going up the hill to go to Kaimuki or Kahala Mall or something like that. And this is the house I always see, straight up. And to be honest, you know, the shadow of the tree in the foreground, they didn't help. The drawing, I should have stopped with just the house and the
I
sidewalk.
Think we're always most self-critical. For somebody who can't draw shade,
yeah.
who can't depict, you know, a very lifelike image, I'm impressed. Okay, it's just the control you have with lines and using different, the variations of lines.
Mm.
It really does come through. And the fact that these images, you're not correcting. That is just so mind-boggling.
Yeah, I never used the whitening.
Yeah, so no white out, no white paint. I mean, like I said, when I was thumbing through your original sketches, they're just so pristine. It's like, how did you commit?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like once the ink is there, but it's just ink, nothing else, and paper.
Yeah.
You have really great control. Like even this one about the people at the bus stop, stylized, but I see them. I mean, the people, the shapes, the forms, they pop.
Yeah. This one, you know, I didn't put any shadow.
At the bus stop?
Right. Mm. This drawing doesn't show any shadows of that.
Right, but stylized.
Yeah.
If anything, because you still have like the dark of his pants, you know, there is still that, the value changes, right? You have the whites, you have the grays, and the blacks. And the way you can just use a squiggly line to indicate like the shadow on the back of his jeans.
Yeah.
Just so impressed. I'm definitely coloring out of the lines already by this point. I don't know how you do this. You do have a gallery showing opening up.
Oh, yes. The show is going to be at Downtown Art Center, and the reception is going to be May 3rd as part of the first Friday in Chinatown, downtown. And it's going to be till beginning of June.
Okay, so about a month.
Yeah.
Up for a month.
And I'll be showing mostly pastel work. Oh, the title of the show is called The Retrospective. So trying to show my past work too. And mostly pastel works. But the watercolor painting that won the Hallmark Award, that's going to be shown. And I also showing one of the architectural renderings. It's not specifically architecture, but it's more like a planning kind of a drawing. It's a bird's eye view of a new city that I was involved in developing. It's a new master plan called Belitung in Indonesia. And so that's big color pencil drawing. You know, I always spend a lot of color pencils, so I have a lot of pencil butts, you know, the ends. I didn't throw away, I just kept them. And then I made a pineapple.
So now you've branched out into sculpture.
Yeah, sort of.
And people who are interested in actually touching and seeing your sketches of Kamiki, it will be there at the Downtown Art Center May 3rd as well.
Right.
What would you like to share with our listeners about your career, the fact that you've been able to collect, you know, your sketches of Kaimuki into this really beautifully bound book, and still continuing to create art?
Well, I'm glad that somebody suggested to publish a book about my sketchbook, and yeah, I was able to share my love for this very modest, unassuming town, Kaimuki, with other people. And I hear that some people, they look at the book and then they remember, and then they bring back some memories, and that make them feel kind of nostalgic to Kaimuki. And well, I'm so happy that the book could do that. Emotionally affects, the book can affect the some people like that.
That was artist Hitoshi Hira and HPR's Lillian Song. They were talking about a new book that features his sketches of Kaimuki that spans four decades. His work will also be featured at the Downtown Arts Center in an exhibit that opens tomorrow night. One highlight is his high school watercolor that won the statewide Best in Show Hallmark Award. Look for links on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org after the show.
I see my papa play that guitar under a coconut tree. Coconut smile takes me back for a while to my childhood and old Kaimuki. To my childhood and old Kaimuki.
Support for HPR comes from Mobi, a Hawaii wireless company serving the island since 2005, committed to providing personal service to each customer, featuring a locally based customer care team. Learn more at mobi.com.
When you're trying to break new ground, at work or with a passion project, how do you move from brainstorming to actually achieving your goals? All this month, Hidden Brain will have answers in a new series, Innovation 2.0. We'll explore the science of creativity and help you find direction. That's Innovation 2.0 on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiian homeowners and renters impacted by the Maui wildfires. More about its Kanaho grant at oha.org/kanaho grant.
And now it's time to release the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we asked you for the name of the man credited for bringing wallabies to Hawaii in the early 1900s. Hawaii's original wallaby population numbered just 3 when our aspiring zookeeper brought them to his residence in Aleva Heights. But in 1916, a pack of dogs attacked the cage housing the wallabies, allowing 2 of them to escape into the forest, a male and a female. Not long after, nature took its course and the wallaby population began to grow, eventually stretching from Halawa to Nu'uanu Valley. There's no firm evidence to confirm, but it's believed that wild pigs, dogs, and human activity have curtailed the growth of the population. And this is a rare instance of an invasive species in Hawaii being controlled without significant human intervention. Today, Hawaii's sole wallaby colony can be found in Halawa Valley. We're told not far from where their original ancestors escaped to freedom from a private zoo owned by Richard Trent, which was the answer to today's backyard quiz. Trent's other famed claim to fame, he was also the city and county of Honolulu's first treasurer. And congrats to Brendan from Kailua. You got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have one to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Mm-hmm.
career of Maori music artist Stan Walker continues to grow beyond his native New Zealand. He's probably best known for winning Australian Idol back in 2009. But in the years since, he's released 6 gold albums, 2 platinum albums, and has become one of Australia and New Zealand's most beloved artists. His first hit single was the dance pop song titled Black Box. So his music has evolved over his 15-year career. More recently, he's incorporated a roots and reggae feel. He's also writing lyrics in his native tongue more frequently, releasing his first Maori language album in 2021. The Conversation's Russell Subiono got the chance to talk to Stan Walker ahead of his concert this Saturday on Oahu.
One cool thing I also read about you is that Beyonce is the main inspiration for doing what you do. Is that true? Did she really inspire you to be a musician?
She's inspired me to be an artist, to be own my stuff, to be creative, to think out of the box. And if I can see anything in my head, if it can happen in my head, it can happen in real life. I've just watched her growing up and she's one of my favorite artists ever. Just what she's done. I mean, it's Beyonce.
Right.
And I always aspire to even be anything like that. So she's definitely been the biggest inspiration. Her and Bob Marley.
Yeah.
Paulie.
Yeah.
Two very different artists, but for me, man, they gangster.
Yeah. From what I can tell, your career was launched after winning Australian Idol in 2009. You released your first single, Black Box, shortly after. Since then, you've released 7 albums and you have a growing fan base. The song of yours that has streamed the most on Spotify is Take It Easy. It has over 18 million plays. Is there a story behind that song?
It's funny because the original version that I recorded for Take It Easy, I wrote with 2 other guys. It was such a weird time. It was like, I didn't like the session at all. And it's funny because when we were writing that song, I was kind of arguing with the 2 guys that we wrote it with. And I came up with the production, the melodies, the everything, and with all the lyrics and stuff like that. And I hated the song. I hated the song. I was like, oh, this is so cheesy. Ugh, I'm just not going to do anything with it. But then I did a movie, Mount Zion. It was the first acting role that I had, and I was the lead role. And so I used this song as the theme song, but we went into the studio. I had to kind of make it a little bit more reggae, a little bit more rootsy. Like, I didn't really understand how to make something reggae back then, because it wasn't like, I mean, I didn't really understand it.
Stronger days, bitter nights, cold hands, warm heart. Walking around, but just staring at the ground. Take hold, fall apart. Little by little, someone blows the whistle. Get the matter in the end. So just slow it all down. Slow it all down. You gotta take it easy, easy. Live your life.
I did one pass on the song. I recorded it from top to bottom. I like the whole song. I did it once over and I was like, ugh, yuck, don't use it. And I heard the actual song, Take It Easy, on the radio. And I heard my voice that it was that one take. And I never got to see it or like listen to it back because I was over it. And I walked out of the studio. And then that song became what it became. Everybody like took to it. And I was angry for ages. But it turned out mean. And I live with it now. But like that was such a... It became what it became, and I'm thankful.
Yeah, it's a fun song, man. I listened to a lot of your music last weekend in preparation for this, and you know, I'm driving around the island. It's such a good theme song or soundtrack to just kind of cruising around the island.
Thank you, man.
In 2021, you released a Maori language album, Te Aroha Nui. Last year, you released the single I Am from the soundtrack for the film Origin, directed by Ava DuVernay, which features lyrics in Te Reo Māori. And earlier this year, you released the single Māori Ki Te Ao. Can you talk about why it is important for you to create music in your native language?
I think it's been the natural evolution for me. It's been a reclamation journey for me. When I first started out in Australia, my culture was kind of banned in terms of like the industry because it wasn't seen as sellable, it wasn't anything, and they didn't understand it, so I wasn't allowed to be myself. I wasn't allowed to speak in my language, sing in my language. And so when I recorded my very first song in my own native tongue, Aotearoa, I was so nervous because I'd always been kind of put down and laughed at for being who I am, and I had to change the way that I talked, the way that I acted, the way that I dressed, like even came down to my hair. When my hair grew out, my natural hair, because I got a bit of an afro and it just goes up, they didn't like it. And I remember having conversations within my label in Australia and they pulled me in a meeting, if you don't cut your hair, your career's over. So everything of my culture, the way that I look, my language, my everything was just like, I was shunned. And so being able to evolve into the person that's always been there and to be able to express that and to be able to sing in my native tongue has been a journey. It's been a journey over the last 15 years of reclamation. And doing the song I Am, that song, well, half the song, is like 7 years old. It'd been living with me for that long. And I remember when I met Ava over phone, she's like, oh, you know, do you have anything? And the song was like my emotional response to the film. And then I wrote the chorus and the bridge with my uncle, and we wrote it in our language. And so I don't ever think now, these days, if I'm gonna intentionally write something in my language or not. Because I don't have any fears around it, I don't have any agenda, or like, I'm not trying to prove myself anymore. I write songs in my language, in English, because I feel like it. But I do lean towards my own language a lot, but it's not something that I have to like try anymore or be intentional about. Doing I Am, I Am is a song about reclamation of our identity. Māori Ki Te Ao is standing in our identity, saying this is who I am. I've been here, I know who I am, I know where I come from. And yeah, so it's been a beautiful journey. I think back to when I was scared to speak my own language, when I was scared to speak in my own twang, like, you know, in my own accent, without getting persecuted or laughed at. To be honest, like, excuse my English, but I don't give a what anybody thinks, because I just am me. But yeah, being able to sing in my language, it was intentional to become that person that I didn't have to think twice. And so now I am that person, and I just make music to make music, whether it's in my language or English, whether it's in both, and it just happens naturally. I'm not trying to push anything, it just comes out.
When I look across your music career, what I hear in your music is someone who is passionate about his culture, as well as somebody who's trying to make a positive impact on the world, putting more positivity out there. What do you hope people take away when they listen to your music?
My ultimate goal, and it's never changed from when I first started to now, is to bring hope, life, healing, and joy to people through my music. Even if my song is a song that's talking about, I don't know, I just feel like eating chicken. Whatever song that I release is a part of my soul and is a part of my purpose, which is to bring hope, life, healing, and joy to people. I mean, we live in a world that's just crazy. And I think because social media has exposed us to the world that's always been crazy and always been out the gate, I can't change the world, But what I can change is the world around me, and I can impact, influence, and hopefully inspire the people within the world that I live in. And so my music is always to bring hope, life, healing, and joy, because, yeah, people need it. I need it, yeah. You know? And so I always look to people, you know, the older I get, man, Bob Marley was the greatest artist for me that ever lived. Nobody could ever be Bob Marley. And he used his music as the tool to bring hope, life, healing, and joy, to bring peace when his own nation was at civil war. I thought he was Māori growing up. Wow. And then somebody, my bro, said, nah, he's Samoan. And I was like, no, he's Māori. We were both wrong. The bro's from Jamaica. But, you know, he's always been Uncle Bob. And I want to have the same impact as him. And he used his music to do these things. I make music now on purpose, to have purpose. And because I'm a father, it's heightened that purpose. It's made that purpose greater. And so I just want to make sure that in my life, that my ceiling will be my kids' floor. The greatest that I achieve, that's where my children begin. And that's why I do what I do even more now, because I've got kids, but it's always to bring hope, life, healing, and joy.
Stan Walker, thanks so much for taking the time to talk.
Thank you so much, bro.
That was Maori music artist Stan Walker talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. Walker and his full band will be performing this Saturday at a concert taking place in the Aloha Stadium parking lot. We'll have a link to more information on the conversation page of our website after the show. Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we hear from the Environmental Protection Agency where things stand with water testing related to Red Hill. Give us some feedback. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And don't forget, you can catch up on past episodes of our show by downloading our podcasts on all major podcast platforms. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation. Ora hi a me tu kue.